Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An increasing number of amateur genealogists have turned to DNA testing for part of their query, uploading the data to websites that point them to otherwise unknown or distant relatives, sometimes entire branches of a family tree. But what they upload in the process may qualify as evidence for law enforcement, which has found a measure of success using DNA databases to track down suspects. Last month, a jury in Washington state convicted a man of a murder using such evidence. But some privacy advocates call the use of DNA databases for such purposes an unlawful invasion of privacy. James Hazel of the Center for Genetic Privacy and Identity and Community Settings at Vanderbilt University Medical Center studies the privacy policies of DNA companies. He joins us. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
When we talk about the DNA companies, how big is that universe now?
Well, we've seen it literally explode in the last decade, with over 26 million individuals having now undergone testing with one of these companies, something that's very different than what we've seen in the past, where people usually sought testing from their doctors or as a part of a research project.
Do they typically download or upload the data to that larger database?
Well, many of these companies allow users to upload or download their raw data. Mm-hmm. It's really up to the person whether they want to seek out a site like GEDmatch to upload their data. But there are a host of companies that are beginning to enter the scene that are offering consumers the ability to upload their data that they got for ancestry purposes and translate it into insights into other things such as their health. So the flow of data is certainly becoming more robust.
And are there standards in the industry as far as how to protect that data in general?
The industry leaders have tried to develop best practices, but our survey of 90 companies operating in the United States showed that as of 2017, companies were really all over the map in terms of what information that that they provided to consumers in their policies and the quality of that information.
So then enter law enforcement. They do need a court order to get access to the data, right?
That is correct. If a company does not wish to voluntarily surrender it, they do need a court order or subpoena to get that data. Now, companies like 23andMe will rigorously oppose such requests. But in the case of public resources like GEDmatch, which you alluded to in the intro, really no court authorization is needed to access those public resources.
You mean I could do it?
You could do it. A detective logging onto his computer could do it. Yes, they access the data as a typical consumer might. And as you can imagine, a typical consumer does not need a court order.
Well, all right. So why should people care? Let's just say, take out the law enforcement piece of this for a second. And why should a consumer care if their DNA information is shared in general?
Well, I mean, there are a host of privacy concerns associated with genetic data and its sharing. Obviously, the data has the potential to reveal sensitive health information about an individual, such as their predisposition to diseases such as Alzheimer's. But what we've seen in the law enforcement context is that the same data also has the ability to implicate not only that individual, but also their relatives in criminal activity.
So when you talk about health issues and health predilection or genetic predilection for health issues, that's an insurance company that might make it valuable to insurance companies?
Yes, insurance companies, employers, individuals who might wish to blackmail someone based on that information as well. And I will note that genetic information also is unique in that it has the ability to reveal family relationships. So it could reveal parentage and related things that might not be known to the individual.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what happens when you upload or download your DNA information into public databases. For one thing, law enforcement can use it as evidence. And for another thing, others, as my guest is describing, can use it for nefarious purposes. James Hazel is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Genetic Privacy and Identity in Community Settings at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-294-2900. 392-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are the critical questions consumers should have when they're looking at those agreements that they sign with these companies?
Well, first, you know, to state the obvious, I think consumers should make an effort to read the policies before undergoing testing and understand how their data will be used and shared by a company. They should also be looking for opportunities that they have to either opt in or opt out of certain activities. So, for example, they should consider whether they have the ability to opt out of law enforcement searches, to opt in or opt out of research activities and other sharing of their data.
It's been mentioned that data is being sold. Is that something that consumers should be concerned about as well?
Yes and no. Genetic data is obviously a very powerful tool for researchers, and some of those research partnerships certainly can lead to advances that could improve the health of our society. However, the important thing is that consumers make an informed decision about whether to participate in such activities.
Could you upload part of your information, keep some of it private and upload others to work on your genealogy, your family tree, that kind of a thing?
That will depend on the service that you're using. So that's something that consumers should also watch out for. I will note that with the recent cases involving GEDmatch and family tree DNA, law enforcement does not actually have access to an individual's raw genetic data. They're simply utilizing the service to determine how related to identify potential relatives of a suspect. And so they can determine a degree of relatedness, but they are not actually viewing or downloading individuals' raw data.
So they're using it to find potential relatives, and that helps them find the suspect. Is that what it's usually being used for?
Yes, and in contrast to what some people think, it's usually not a cut and dry match. Law enforcement in these type of searches will get dozens or even hundreds of potential leads, potential relatives, based on the crime scene sample that they uploaded. They then have to do a lot of investigatory work on the back end, trying to pinpoint the rough age of the perpetrator, their geographic location at the time of the crime, to finally narrow in on the suspect. And that raises some privacy issues in that those type of long-range searches can actually be quite error-prone.
You know, you mentioned 26 million people have availed themselves of these services. I mean, is the cow kind of out of the barn? Is there any way to bring it back in once you've downloaded, once you've engaged in this?
Again, that depends heavily on the privacy policies in terms of service of the companies that the individual utilizes and uploads their data to. So that's another reason that individuals really need to be on the lookout for what the data practices are with a given company. Some will allow consumers to delete all or some of that data. Others make it much more difficult.
And that's because there's an advantage to them in that case.
Yes, or the data might have already been shared with another third party, in which case it's, as you said, the cat is out of the bag.
Is a consumer entitled to be notified when the data has been shared?
Usually consumers are not individually notified when data is shared. And even surprisingly, our study showed that very, very few companies would even notify consumers if their data was the subject of a data breach.
Huh. That's interesting, versus, say, a Target credit card breach.
Correct, yes.
What do you see on the horizon as far as technology goes that could mitigate these problems or exacerbate them?
Well, I think one of the big questions here is, what is the appropriate level of regulation for these activities? On the one hand, they are an incredible resource for law enforcement that, as you mentioned, have resulted in dozens of suspects being apprehended as a result. However, the question remains, should law enforcement need to obtain court orders for these searches? Should legislatures enact laws that place restrictions on the type of crimes that can be used, where this technique can be used, et cetera? Because right now, really, it all boils down to the terms of service of a particular company serving as the only limits to what law enforcement can or cannot do with their service.
Is the approach a state by state, or should, or is this something they're talking about at the federal level?
You know, given how slowly things generally progress at the federal level, mm-hmm. I would suspect that this would likely be a state by state effort. We've seen that same thing with familial searches of the same type, but using government-run databases. Some states place many restrictions on those searches, others less so. So I think that can serve as a model for potential regulations of these activities when they occur, not in government-run databases, but in these public databases.
Western Europe always seems to be ahead of the game on these kinds of issues. Is there any template over there that they're using, any models or best practices that you see that could be adapted here?
Well, yes, the GDPR in Europe certainly has changed the game, and it remains to be seen what effect that will have on law enforcement searches. Interestingly, Family Tree DNA, which partnered with the FBI to perform these searches, they recently shifted their policies to allow consumers to opt out of these searches. So in the United States, consumers can opt out. However, in Europe, they automatically opted everyone out, and it requires an affirmative opt-in for the searches to occur. So that's an interesting development.
And do we know how many people are opting in?
With a related site, GED Match, recently shifted to a similar policy, and from what I understand, very few of the total number of individuals actually opted in for these law enforcement searches, which dramatically reduced the effectiveness of this resource.
Right. So, is there any sense about how these DNA companies are, what they're looking for in the final analysis? Because it's so unsettled at this point. Would they rather just have the regulations and know what is allowed, or would they rather it be sort of the Wild Wild West still?
Well, I think with the large players like 23andMe and Ancestry, they've recently been lobbying in D.C. For regulations surrounding genetic data. Obviously, they're hoping to have a say in crafting those regulations so that they won't undermine their bottom line.
Does the severe, when it comes to law enforcement, does the severity of the crime come into play in all of this, or could they ostensibly use these searches for anything from, you know, petty theft all the way up to murder?
Well, the two companies that currently cooperate with law enforcement, they do state that they should only be used for serious crimes like murder, sexual assault, or to identify remains. However, we saw recently that GEDmatch actually made an exception to that policy and allowed law enforcement to investigate a brutal assault case in Utah. So really, again, the only barrier is the terms of service of the companies. And with the recent developments limiting the size of these databases to law enforcement, it remains to be seen whether law enforcement will adhere to these terms of service, or whether they might try and pose as a consumer in order to gain access to the full resource.
Gotcha. Well, James Hazel, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
James Hazel is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Genetic Privacy and Identity in Community Settings at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The 2020 census, for the first time, will give respondents an online option, but the technology needed to do so is a big lift for an already resource-challenged agency, already embroiled in controversy over the proposed citizenship question. New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby has been covering the issue. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How is the online option supposed to work?
Basically, this time, as they envision it, the majority of households would receive basically a notice in the mail saying, please go online and go to this website and fill out basically the census questionnaire there, and that would, they're hoping, largely replace the format of getting, you know, mailing out the questionnaire and people mailing it back in hard copy form, which has been pretty much the dominant model since 1970.
So you'd fill out the questionnaire online, and how would they check? Would that just be an option? And but you could also wait for the hard copy too?
Yes, everyone would be able to. It's important for people to note that if you don't have internet access, you will still be able to fill out your census questionnaire, and anyone is able to fill it out online in paper, or there's actually phone response option this time too.
Is this a money issue? Is this an accuracy issue? What do they think they'll gain by this online option?
Well, this was a response to just the rapidly rising cost of conducting the census, and it had been going up and up and up, and they had been you know, increasing costs while actually the response rate had been lowering, and it was getting to just an unsustainable point in 2010 when it cost, you know, roughly $12 billion to conduct the census, which is the most expensive ever. It's grown progressively more expensive to reach each household and actually count each household. So in constant 2020 dollars, it cost about $16 to count one housing unit in 1970, and by 2010 that had ballooned to about $92 per housing unit. So the technology was really, as much as it does create some new problems, it was also, it's widely seen as a justified embrace of a new method to that could bring both productivity and efficiency gains and also save a lot of money. The question is that by doing this and fixing one problem, you introduce many other new potential risks that come with this technology.
Right. Okay. So I was going to ask you about that. The Bureau already has found an insecure backdoor during an audit last year. What was the problem there?
So this was something that the Commerce Department's Office of Inspector General found last year, and it was so serious that they immediately notified the Bureau, even though their audit was ongoing, and had them correct this. It was the Bureau to conduct the census online and to store a lot of information online and have a lot of computing power so that you are actually able to manage when a lot of people are coming to the census website all at once to fill it out potentially. They have used cloud computing services from Amazon Web Services, and that's not really uncommon. A number of other government agencies have done that as well. What they didn't realize was that in this case, there was basically by creating these cloud environments, they by default created what is almost like master users that have unlimited privileges to access, alter, or potentially delete data that is stored. And that would be data that they've actually collected from people in the field, and they had essentially lost the access credentials to these master users, you could think of them. And fortunately, in this case, they believed that they caught it and there was nothing compromised after the Inspector General notified them. But it was sort of an alarming sort of wake-up call that the IG called potentially catastrophic if they hadn't caught it.
Then you also wrote that the Bureau had to scale back from three tests to one. First of all, what do these tests involve?
So the key things, they do a number of tests in the lead up to 2020.
Kind of like a dry run. Yeah.
Yeah, the key one is what they call the end-to-end test, where they basically do a dress rehearsal, as they call it, and it's just testing everything, all of your systems, basically all the way through as if you were going to conduct the actual census. And they were scheduled to do this in three locations: Providence County, Rhode Island, Southern West Virginia, which is, had a lot of rural areas, and then in Washington State, an area with some tribal lands and military bases. The idea was to test these systems in a number of different types of environments, which is particularly important, obviously, because, you know, internet connectivity is more of an issue in places like Southern West Virginia than it would be in Providence.
Mm-hmm.
But they, for budgetary reasons, had to pretty much scrap the West Virginia and Washington locations, and they just did the test in Providence County, Rhode Island. The concern there being that you don't know necessarily how these systems are going to respond in different environments when you have different conditions, and there has been quite a bit of concern that there may be unknown unknowns, things, risks that they just haven't identified because they simply haven't been able to test it.
What is the resource issue? Why the funding problem?
Well, and this is kind of something that happens a lot with the census, unfortunately.
Because we only talk about it every 10 years.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so right now it seems like there's a lot of momentum to get them the funding they needed. But really, they needed funding back in 2013, 2014. And it's a difficult situation for them because they're left having to go and ask for money from Congress, where there's really not a lot of political incentive for people in Congress to provide that funding at that point, because it's something that seems very distant and down the road. The problem is that these sorts of, when you have budget cuts or shortfalls, you have delays, and those things tend to spiral, and there's a very tight timeline here for conducting this census, and it's mandated by the Constitution. And so if you fall behind, it's very difficult to catch up. And so even though they think they feel like they're okay now funding going forward, which, you know, I guess still remains to be seen, but they feel that way, they're sort of, you know, paying for lack of funding from years ago when we were not that interested in this, unfortunately.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the technology that revolves around the 2020 census. My guest is New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby, who's been covering the issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned that from the 1970s to current, the cost per household has ballooned from about $17 to $92. Where has the increase, do we know, besides inflation, obviously, where's the increase come from?
Yeah, well, and it's actually, that's held in constant dollars. So the issue with that is, well, there are a number of reasons, but, you know, what people generally point to is that society has become more complex. There's more issues. There's more language issues in reaching people, so it's difficult to reach people. There is growing distrust of government, unfortunately. And when the largest cost for the census is when people don't respond initially. So in the past, that's been not mailing back their forms, and they actually have to send field workers out there going door to door trying to count people. And that's what gets really time consuming and expensive. And that they have just, you know, spent a lot of money on that recently.
Field workers are going to be given smartphones this time around. That's another change, right?
Yes.
What's that for?
That is another thing that has a lot of potential for productivity and efficiency gains, but also again, introduces risk.
Right.
And also there's sort of the more mundane issue of people just having trouble using their smartphones. you know, they actually discovered during one test that people were just having some trouble entering the information into the application on their smartphone. So when they're going door to door, they're actually having, you know, asking people the questions and entering it into the smartphones. And so, you know, that theoretically would be a good thing if everything works according to plan. And these smartphones also have an application that can sort of manage the people in the field to make sure they're not duplicating their work, to send them on optimal routes so they're not, you know, driving across town and then back town, and then, you know, that they're not taking really inefficient approaches to trying to count people. And again, if that works, that's, you know, has great potential, but there have been some problems with that during the testing.
That's also going to be expensive, right? Smartphones, I don't know, unless they get the bottom line, and then, you know, you have other risks that way as well.
Right. I mean, I think that they're anticipating that even with, obviously, it does cost quite a bit of money to give a smartphone to all these thousands of census workers who are going to go out across the country. But I think they, you know, they feel like if it works correctly and there are not a lot of costs with fixing things that go wrong, that that actually would make up for it in efficiency gains.
Going back to the issue of an online option, you know, mentioned some of the challenges these days are more language issues, growing distrust of government, and just non-responses. Are they hoping that by having online option that will mitigate some of those problems?
I think that's one thought behind the online issue, but I think it's not the driving issue is basically cost reduction on going to the online form.
Okay. The online disinformation campaigns have become an issue as well. You know, that's a function of social media, right?
Largely, yes. And this is something that's another new potential risk for this census is that we see something like we did around the 2016 presidential campaign. And we have already started to see this, in fact, you know, in talking with researchers who monitor this, it is largely right now, it appears to be what they're seeing, what they tell me they're seeing is largely sort of content on far right websites that are sort of stoking fear about largely around the citizenship question. You know, a number of people referred me to a website that is pretty notorious neo-Nazi website where there's been, you know, a post suggesting that people sign up as census workers and go door to door and then report people they suspect to be illegal immigrants from to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that would actually be illegal. They could face up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine if they were to do that. But I think the larger concern is that there's already this intense fear out there in some communities about what the government's intentions are in asking this question. And even if the question is not on the census going forward, to some degree, the damage has been done. And so the greater risk is that you just have misinformation is amplified online on social media.
And then there's, of course, they're still waiting. Supposedly, it was last Monday that they were supposed to, you know, start printing the census forms that are going to be printed. Is that still an issue? I mean, have they started printing them or what's going on? Because it's still up in the air.
Right. I mean, as far as we know, they are printing them, but without the question on there, the citizenship question.
Okay.
But this is very much up in the air still. And I think you saw even just yesterday the Attorney General William Barr saying that there was going to be some, that they felt confident that they were going to be able to come up with some way to potentially come up with a new reason to justify the citizenship question, one that would satisfy the Supreme Court, unlike the previous reason that they gave, which the court found was essentially a pretext, not a legitimate justification for adding the question. So we'll see what that is. The career Justice Department lawyers who were on the case are now off the case. And so they're scrambling to have a new legal team in place at this time where they're already, time is critical for figuring out basically what's going on and what's going to actually be on the questionnaire going forward.
Well, all things being equal, there's so many variables that we've just got done talking about. But all things being equal, what is the census? What is the agency anticipating as far as participation online? Is there a percentage yet? And does it dictate how many forms they'll print out?
I don't know exactly what their predictions are for online response, but they do have basically the backup. They have a whole system in place where, you know, if you don't respond initially online, they'll give you a certain number of chances and then you'll get notice in the mail. And then you'll have one of the workers, field workers show up at your door. So, I mean, I think, you know, that they're hoping for, obviously, that this will improve response, but I think that remains to be seen.
Are they looking at, you know, there's the community survey, I can't remember what it's called now, but there's another census that comes out in every 5 years, and it goes out to a certain number of people, not everybody. Mm-hmm. Are they looking at doing that online as well, or are they waiting to see how this works?
You know, I'm not sure the answer to that. And I think you mean the American Community Survey.
Thank you.
This is what they send out more regularly to a sample of the population. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Chris Hamby, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Chris Hamby, New York Times investigative reporter. He's been covering the issue of technology and the census. There are worries about disinformation, hacking, glitches, you name it. They want to go online. And also, they'll be using smartphones. The field workers will be using smartphones. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From smartphones to smartwatches to standalone technology, fitness trackers are everywhere, but the accuracy of those trackers might be overrated. Joining us is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So they don't always work like they're supposed to. Tell us what's going wrong.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of the inexpensive, fitness trackers are not totally different from the step counters that have been around for forever. You know, they're simple, you know, kind of up and down sensors that measure when you do something that is closely related to taking a step. And so, you know, a lot of times you run into things like the Fitbit that is all about getting those 10,000 steps every day. But, you know, just riding in a car on a bumpy road can give you a couple hundred steps. If you,
good to know.
So it's a good way to cheat if you're looking for it. But if you're actually trying to actively track, what your fitness level is and how much you have been active throughout the course of a day, then some of these less expensive trackers can actually be really deceptive in the amount of information they provide you, especially when it comes to things like calories burned. And your general activity level. The way to solve this in a couple of different ways just involves a little more advanced technology.
Advanced technology or advanced knowledge of technology on the part of the user?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, there's definitely a little bit of both. I found through some of my own testing that running, for example, with a fitness tracker that doesn't have GPS enabled often gives me results that are very different from reality. You know, so if I have GPS enabled on my fitness tracker, which a lot have, but not all of them, then it gives me a pretty accurate readout of how far I've been running. If I use, you know, kind of the entry level Fitbit, for example, which does not have GPS enabled, and I go to run for 3 miles or something, it'll often tell me that I've only run for maybe 2 miles or 2.5 miles, because it's trying to give me an average of my gait based on the information that I've given it as far as my height and my weight and things like that, instead of being able to measure the actual distance.
I've noticed that when I'm walking the dog, often my smartwatch will pop up and say, it looks like you're working out. But when I'm in boot camp busting my can, it doesn't say a thing.
Yeah, so the automated things are even trickier. And Apple has recently added, this kind of automated, it looks like you're working out thing, and a couple other companies are looking to do the same. And what that's looking for is repetition. So if it notices the same kind of activity over and over again, then it'll try and do that. And when you're doing some kind of boot camp thing, frequently you're shifting back and forth between exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And so that actually is not repetition as far as the watch is concerned. And that's why it doesn't automatically try and track those things. Which is just another step of, these things aren't quite smart enough yet to be able to tell us everything.
What is the best brand of fitness tracker in your opinion?
I tend to lean more towards either the high-end Fitbits that have GPS tracking enabled, like the Fitbit Ionic or the Fitbit Versa, any of the Garmin fitness trackers. Garmin fitness trackers tend to have a lot more accuracy when it comes to calories reported. When it comes to energy spent, and of course, being Garmin, their GPS trackers are very, very good.
So the smartwatches, not so much.
Smartwatches are, they're really great at delivering the notifications, but they're also, they just tend to not give you a lot of the really useful information when it comes to health. The Apple Watch does a great job at giving you a wide variety of things to track. So for the individual workouts, you can get some pretty useful information from them. But that whole three ring completion thing, it's very easy to trick. I not intentionally, but tricked it to while I was driving, and I get a little notification that popped up on my Apple Watch earlier this week that said, "Hey, congratulations, you completed your rings," which included standing up, once an hour. I'd been in my car for 2 hours. I hadn't gotten up. I hadn't moved. So it's tricky. So that kind of information as kind of the problem is that a lot of times these are sold as whole body, whole health things where you can see, throughout the course of an entire day, how useful they are. A lot of the smartwatches are much better at giving you information on individual workouts. So if I ride my bike for a while, then the information I get from the watch is pretty useful, but not so much as a whole day thing.
The best thing about my smartwatch is that I can talk to it like Dick Tracy. And that's just the bottom line right there. Nothing beats that.
That definitely has its uses. Can't go wrong there.
So do you think that someday they'll make Prime Day like a Hallmark holiday?
I honestly, the direction that we're headed, it's not going to be a day. It's going to be a week. It's going to be treated as though it's an entire week of, how right now, like we call it Black Friday, but
yeah.
Really like it's an entire month of November.
Right.
We're probably looking at something similar to that heading the direction for Prime Day. So it's not a single day anymore. As you've no doubt discussed previously, starting next week, it'll actually be 2 days. That's even also not true because Amazon has actually started adding Prime Day sales already to places that its physical stores are located. So any of the Amazon Books stores or any of the Amazon 4-star locations are places where any of the products that are in those stores that are going to be a part of the Prime Day online sale are actually already on sale right now for you to go and purchase.
What is a 4-star store?
It's not quite a bookstore. It's designed to hold some of the stuff that would be very popular in some of their warehouse locations. So it's almost like, things that Amazon knows are really popular in that area. There aren't very many of them yet. And there's actually been some rumor that 4-star designs will actually be added onto Whole Foods at some point. But that's just been conjecture so far. This is something that Amazon has been experimenting with for a while is kind of building out these physical stores, which is, I would say ironic, but it's actually just sad given how many actual bookstores Amazon has cannibalized in its life, to then open physical stores that sell books. These locations, if you have been, if you have your eye on something that's available for Prime Day and you're near one of these physical locations, you don't actually have to wait. You can just go and get it today.
You don't have to wait a day. You can get it right away.
Right, you don't have to wait. Well, you wouldn't be able to place the order until next week.
Oh, I see.
You'd
okay,
be able to go right now.
And why are they offering the in-person deals? You have to be a member. Are they trying to get people signed up?
I think, yeah, a big part of the Amazon Prime Day experience is not so much getting people who are already Prime members to subscribe. It's about getting people hooked on things like Amazon Music, Amazon Prime Video, you know, the additional services that come with Amazon that you maybe would pay a little extra for. Those are the things that Amazon is really hoping to get people excited about.
Have you ever seen that Black Mirror episode? Oh, no, it was Electric Dreams episode about a company like Amazon that kept producing things even after an apocalyptic.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, all right, Prime Day. What days are that? Is that anyways? Is that
coming? Going to be the 15th and 16th.
15th and 16th of July. Hallmark, take note. Of course, they all probably end up buying Hallmark eventually, or maybe who knows who even owns it now. Windows has released a game that involves Stranger Things. I have not played it yet, but I really would like to. Tell us about the game. Stranger Things, of course, the Netflix, which is now in its third season on Netflix.
What's absolutely. So Microsoft did this thing a couple weeks ago where they started teasing something called Windows 1.0. Which is obviously very confusing to people who are currently using Windows version 10, why they would be talking fondly about releasing what was essentially the original version of Windows for people to use. And it turns out that this is it's a marketing thing with Netflix for Stranger Things. You can actually, if you have a Windows PC, you can go and install this game. It's called Windows 1.11. And it essentially is a game that is built in the world of Windows 1.0. So you can actually go through and you're essentially using the computer interface to try and help the characters from Stranger Things deal with the challenges seen in this current season of the show.
Well, what do you think?
I think that it's a lot of fun for Stranger Things nerds. I've had a lot of fun sitting down and just kind of poking around at things. I wonder how many people are really going to feel that nostalgia, because I feel like a lot of people my age probably didn't start using Windows until Windows 3.1. So some of that may be a little lost, especially since computers were just prohibitively expensive at the time and not a lot of people had them. But everyone that I know that, was around during that time or is just a fan of Stranger Things has enjoyed it so far.
Oh, okay. And what's the interface like? What does it look like? Just old?
Oh, it's ancient. It's all the buttons. It's all very pixelated and hilariously nostalgic, given what it looks like compared to the actual computer you're running it on.
How have you liked the third season?
I am about halfway through. It is the first time that I have had to not watch it all the way through because my oldest daughter has demanded to watch every episode with me.
Okay.
So I can't watch when she is asleep, or I'm afraid that she will wake up and do things to me.
Right. I'm about the same place too. So we have no spoilers on this show. Apple is replacing its keyboard going forward. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so there was actually an announcement today. Apple released an update to its MacBook line for kids for back to school. Anyone entering first year of college or going into high school, they'll be able to take advantage of some additional sales from Apple. But the big thing here is the base model of the MacBook Pro has actually ditched that top row of keys where the function buttons used to be in exchange for the touchpad that has been seen on the higher end models of the MacBook. So now all of the versions of the MacBook have this touch interface up top where you can, set your own shortcuts and kind of adjust things the way that you want. But it does mean that, the keyboard itself is no longer an all physical experience like was previously available.
The touchpad, is that what they're calling the scissor keyboard?
No, so the what's happening right now, the physical keys on the MacBook keyboard are using what's called the butterfly switches,
okay,
which is a design that Apple came up with on its own, and those are sticking around for a little while, but they have some pretty significant flaws as far as getting dust and debris underneath of them, and trying to clean them out is actually kind of challenging. So you end up with a lot of people who are very heavy MacBook users that have keys that just kind of stop working after days of use, not just months So they end up having to take it to the Apple store. So the big rumor right now from Apple is that they're working on a new keyboard to replace this in the next generation that they are calling Scissor Keys, that are going to address this butterfly keyboard and hopefully fix all of those problems. But it's not here yet. So if you're looking to buy a keyboard, if you're looking to buy a MacBook right now, just be aware that this keyboard has some pretty well-documented flaws, and it does not always break for everyone, but when it does, it requires a trip to the Apple store to get fixed.
When did these problems start popping up? How long has that been a problem?
As soon as the butterfly keyboard came out 3 years ago. It started as this kind of dull, hey, did you notice that this... your keyboard was acting a little funny, and Apple's kind of downplayed it a little bit and said, this it's only affecting a small number of people. And over the last couple of years, that number has grown pretty significantly. And now, this is a drop in the bucket to how many people actually own MacBooks. But every single person that I work with that uses a MacBook has had very similar problems to the one that I have. So I think it definitely impacts heavy users and active typists a lot more than maybe kind of, I guess normal people. I'm going to go ahead and just call myself abnormal when it comes to how much I write on a daily basis on my keyboard. It's probably very different from most folks.
So if you have one of those keyboards, you just bring it in and they clean it for you, or do they replace it, or what?
No, if you bring it in and say, hey, this one key is sticking, I don't really understand what's going on, they take it back behind the counter for a couple seconds and it comes out and everything's fine. Because they have a special little tool that they use that lifts up the key just enough to get some compressed air under there, but not enough to actually damage the key. And then they send you on your way and everything is fine. It would be super cool if Apple would release that tool to the public so that people could just clean their own keys. Hmm. But I think that there's a genuine concern there that the keys could be damaged if you lift a little too hard or anything like that.
Or Apple doesn't like you to fix your own stuff anyways.
Apple is pretty against the concept of people repairing their own stuff, and that's an entirely separate issue.
It is an entirely separate issue, but how's that going? I mean, is there a lawsuit? Is there not?
There have been when it comes to getting displays repaired and things like that, and that's kind of an ongoing issue, the right to repair something that you've purchased. And it's something that Apple has relaxed in some ways on, increasing its partnerships with other companies. But it's still, it's a pretty constant problem, and it has been for a long time. Apple has been pretty significantly negative about, consumers repairing their own equipment.
What else? What are you going to be looking at this week, Russell Holly?
This week, I'm actually going to be looking at a new 360-degree camera that is designed to be, kind of attached and worn in a really weird way to give you some unique perspective for virtual reality cameras. But also, I have a secret addiction to trackball mice. I don't actually like normal mice for keyboards, and I have a new trackball mouse from Logitech that allows you to kind of hold your hand and ergonomic position and be a little safer for kind of daily active use without causing cramps or damage in your hand.
Well, so the one thing I thought the mice now on the market already were doing that.
A lot of mice have, more ergonomic use for them. I am not a huge fan of normal laser mice, moving my hand around or doing. It's just I was raised on trackballs, so trackballs are just what I'm more comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely not one is better than the other. It's just what I was comfortable with. But lots of other people prefer mice, so new trackballs don't get released all that often. So when a new trackball comes out, I get very excited, and then I spend entirely too much time poking at all the new buttons on it.
Are you looking forward to that day when everything is virtual reality and you can just poke around in the sky?
Maybe. There's definitely some advantages to the whole touch interface, but I think I'm so used to having a mouse and keyboard for certain things that I don't have to like look down at my keyboard or anything like that. And I don't know how we impose muscle memory in a virtual environment, like where you just automatically know to reach out and poke that thing.
Yeah.
And know that button is there without some kind of tactile response. I don't know how that works in VR.
Hmm. Good answer. Russell Holly, thanks so much for your time as always. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's contributing editor for Android Central. He's here every Tuesday on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.